case for argument today is 22-1854, Demasi versus HHS. Mr. Day, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. It is undisputed that the Special Master applied the wrong legal standards when he denied Ms. Demasi's Rule 60 motion. The Secretary makes no effort to defend many errors in the decision below. Applying the correct legal standards to the undisputed facts here, Ms. Demasi is entitled to relief for two reasons. First, a mistake of fact infected the Special Master's compensation decision. This mistake of fact was raised in a timely motion by Ms. Demasi, and the equities tip clearly in her favor, so she's entitled to relief under Rule 60b-1. To be clear, it is a judicial mistake that justifies relief here, not an attorney mistake. The Special Master adopted an incorrect symptom onset narrative by relying on the Chen and Fisher medical records. Counsel failed to object to those records and may, therefore, have led to the mistake entering the record.
But well, that's what I'm a little confused about. I know what your second point is going to be, so you don't pay it. But I'm a little confused about that because you say DOJ didn't recognize, which it did actually. It's a section in their brief dealing with judicial mistake. But when the narrative of explanation of judicial mistake all takes us back to what the attorney did.
I don't think that's right. So ultimately, the Special Master adopted a symptom onset narrative. That narrative was based on the Chen and Fisher records, and it was just wrong. It was a mistake of fact under Kemp versus United States, as the Supreme Court has defined mistake. It's an error of fact of law, fact or law, whether by the courts or the party. And
well, can I ask you just to go on to the merits of that question, though, leaving aside. I'm sorry, Judge Toronto.
Just before you shift the topic, I just want to ask this question. I'm having trouble imagining what lawyer mistake could actually have produced a non-harmless, erroneous outcome unless it turned into a judicial mistake. So I'm having some trouble seeing the distinction that you're urging.
Yes, Judge Toronto, in many cases, a non-harmless attorney mistake will result in a judicial mistake, but it's not clear that's the facts here. So much of the Secretary's brief is devoted to exactly this question, the fact that there's no attorney mistake or arguably no attorney mistake in the record, that counsel here took intentional conduct, but ultimately the Special Master inadvertently adopted a symptom onset narrative that is just wrong. It is a narrative that had initial onset of the symptom, neurological symptoms after the vaccine within minutes, not days of that vaccine, as is the clear records between December 5th and December 8th, as well as Ms. Demasi's unequivocal testimony throughout the litigation.
And maybe you should get back to Judge Prost's question, but I do want you to, I'm willing to, assume for present purposes that symptom onset narrative was in fact just wrong, but that would lead me to the question whether it really is the case that it made a material difference to the Special Master's determination or indeed to Dr. Leist's testimony on which the Special Master relied in concluding that when they looked at the pre-vaccination records, those records really did show the relevant symptoms. So at that point it would be a harmlessness question. On that question, we haven't gotten to significant aggravation yet.
Well, that was the next question I was going to pose as well about how why the onset would even if there was an error, why it was material. And your response to that argument is that it, quote, underestimates the impact of the allegedly mistaken records, that they were a key pillar. But I have a hard time seeing where anything about how quickly symptoms arrive post-vaccine affected the Special Master's reasoning.
Yes, it did, because fundamentally the symptom onset narrative is a cohesive whole. The finding about the pre-vaccine existence of the conditions rolls up fundamentally the reaction immediately after the vaccine. The special master here was looking at the entire symptom onset narrative. And one of the most important facts, if not the most important fact, is how she reacted to that vaccine and what were the symptoms that resulted from
that
vaccine.
Well, can you point us to anything in the compensation decision or in the reconsideration denial where the analysis and the result is predicated explicitly on that fact? Because I know that fact is in there, in the opinion, sort of in the background, but not in the analysis section.
So at Appendix 24 in the compensation decision, the special master describes how it was a critical question when Mr. Macy's symptoms first developed to function as the critical question that he was looking at when determining whether she was entitled to compensation. So I think that framing of the critical question provides an overarching framework by which the special master denied compensation. And then he goes on to recite the Chen and Fisher medical records as a key part of how those symptoms onset. And ultimately, the narrative of symptom onset is a cohesive whole. It's a complex determination, and this is one of the most important facts. And I think it's important to note that the special master himself never said that he would have reached the same outcome had Mr. Macy's symptoms onset in the way that she described in her Rule 60 motion. And that's it from 192 to 194 in the appendix in the Rule 60 decision. He's discussing the pre-vaccination onset of symptoms. And in those pages, there's no clear indication that the special master would have reached the same conclusion but for the initial onset, minutes onset.
I guess I still don't fully grasp why it isn't harmless error, given that the special master found that her condition pre-existed the vaccine. So are you saying the symptom onset post-vaccination somehow dislodges the finding of pre-existing condition?
Yes. I think it's impossible to know whether the special master would have reached the same decision. So ultimately, the special master was looking at the full symptom onset narrative, and it was undisputed that Mr. Macy had conditions and that she had a vaccine and had an adverse reaction. So the special master's job was to fit this case into one of three buckets. Either those conditions were before the vaccine, either those conditions could have been after the vaccine but not caused by the vaccine, or they could have been after the vaccine and caused by the vaccine. And one of the key facts that played in, that would have played into that analysis is the reaction that she suffered immediately after the vaccine, and not onset of neurological symptoms that occurred minutes but days after that administration.
Well, if my colleagues are amenable, I'll move on to the significant aggravation issue. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Let me just start off by saying, to be clear, you're arguing the significant aggravation issue only as a Rule 60B6 and not a B1, correct?
Yes, that's how we framed it, but I think if the court views the rule that the secretary has conceded exists, that a counsel cannot settle or otherwise compromise in a comparable way their client's claims without authority, as a 60B1 issue, there's no difference on whether it applies under 60B1 or 60B6.
Well, 60B6, from my mind, requires extraordinary circumstances, right? So
yes.
If you're in the 60B6 bucket, we've got to conclude that the question before us is whether the special master abused his discretion in not finding the requisite extraordinary circumstances here. That would be our standard. That's what we're reviewing, right?
Yes, that's right. And I think the rule, if the rule sounds in 60B6, then it counts as an exceptional circumstance when an attorney compromises their claim without authority to do so under this very narrow rule that's intended to protect the authority of individuals to set the objects of their litigation and protect issues specifically reserved to the client's authority.
So,
Mr. Day, just before you go on, what do you think might be the 60B1 basis for this grievance?
I don't think there is a strong 60B1 basis for this argument. Yeah, I don't think that there's really a mistake. I don't see where there's an error of law or fact or some kind of inexcusable neglect.
Now, you analogize the decision not to press a significant aggravation theory to a settlement or consent judgment. Do you have any case law supporting their idea, that idea? We're choosing a theory, which theory not to press in an extraordinary circumstance justify reopening in the sense that it's analogous to counsel improperly settling or consenting to a judgment?
No, we don't have any authority saying that choosing a theory, but I don't think that's the case here. Ultimately, significant aggravation is a distinct claim from initial onset under the Vaccine Act. The Vaccine Act focuses on the injury suffered and the difference between a significant aggravation claim.
So let me ask you, do you have these cases that deal with settlement or consent judgments? Do any of those cases, because I didn't see any in the analysis the government did on your cases, that involve a claim, even accepting, arguendo, your argument, this is not a theory, this was a separate claim. Any cases that deal with settling or consenting judgment on one claim of several alternative claims?
No, I don't think I saw any cases on which there was a partial settlement rather than a full settlement. But I don't think that makes a difference under the rule. Ultimately, it's still comparable to settling a claim, which is a decision reserved for the client here. It amounted to a stipulation of judgment against Mr. Macy on the availability of any significant aggravation claim. And I see I'm into my rebuttal time, Your Honor.
That's okay. You're our only case for the day, so we'll drag this out a little longer. I'm still troubled. The significant aggravation claim, I definitely appreciate your distinction between a claim and alternative litigation-oriented arguments about a single claim, two separate claims. But how does her lawyer go forward and argue there's significant aggravation when she is adamant that her symptoms didn't exist prior to the vaccination? So how can a lawyer in good faith, argue an aggravation claim contrary to his client's representations?
I think there's actually a clear path in this case where he could have argued these claims in the alternative. Mr. Macy always recognized that she had cardiac and neurological symptoms that preceded the vaccine, and she always recognized that medical records could be misunderstood in a way that resulted in the wrong outcome. So the only argument you'd have to present here is, well, if you disagree with me, I don't think I have any pre-existing condition, but if you disagree with me, I clearly got worse. And that would be the substance of the significant aggravation claim, and it wouldn't require any inconsistent statement across the initial onset claims.
Can I ask you about that, just going off a little bit on the side, so I apologize to my colleagues, but her argument on appeal, her informal brief, and then before you all got into the act, which we very much appreciate, she did reference the aggravation issue, but her prominent, besides Chen and Fisher, was the fact that her counsel didn't let her take the stand or didn't make all the arguments she had with respect to why that pre-existing stuff was wrong, was absolutely incorrect as a factual matter. And in fact, some of the stuff you cite, one of her emails, which is like four pages, you cite one sentence, just two sentences dealing with significant aggravation. And there are just paragraphs and paragraphs where she details her complaint. That's still before us in this case. You haven't mentioned that argument. So what are we supposed to do with that? And if in fact we remanded the case, is that still a live issue?
So I think if you remanded and found that a mistake justified reopening, then the issue about initial onset...
We're not talking about a mistake. I'm talking about the aggravation. On the significant aggravation, is that still an open question? Under the 60B6, she is arguing more strenuously than the argument you're making about aggravation, the fact that there was no pre-existing condition. And she's arguing that the reason the lawyer failed her was because he didn't put her on the witness stand or didn't present all of her arguments with respect to why those pre-existing conditions were not valid. That's an issue before us. That was one of her dominant arguments in her informal brief. What are we supposed to do with that?
Yes, I think it's an argument that's still before the court. Ultimately, it would be analyzed under the same legal frameworks that we presented for Rule 60b-6, or a mistake if the argument is that there's an underlying factual error or legal error that the attorney made that resulted in this conduct. I think she faces a tougher road in showing that that warrants relief. Choosing to put her on the stand or not is much closer to the kind of decision reserved for an attorney.
Well, it's not just, she's not only arguing put it on the stand. My recollection of the details is she's saying you should have put these facts on somehow. She's not just arguing on the stand. She goes through extraordinary detail for every one of those pre-existing meetings and doctor's appointments and gives an alternative explanation for why those doctors are wrong. So even leaving aside the question about whether that's still a live claim, because I think we have to do something with that, but doesn't that, as I think the chief started to allude, doesn't that play into what's going on here in terms of the attorney making the choice? Are you envisioning the case would have gone that he would have put her on the stand or put on all of these arguments as to why those pre-existing conditions were wrong, and then she would have sat there and listened to all of these arguments about why she had pre-existing conditions, and she would put on a case as to why those pre-existing conditions were valid?
No, I don't think that's the case she would need to present. I think she would only need to recognize that there were some cardiac and neurological symptoms that pre-existed the vaccine.
Well, she didn't, but she doesn't recognize that. She hasn't, and she continues to be adamant in all of her filings that that was not the case. So you say she needs to change her mind?
No, I think I'm not being clear with my phrasing. So when I say pre-existing cardiac and neurological symptoms, I mean she suffered some cardiac symptoms that were not related to any condition that is the basis for her vaccine. So she would never have to concede or even affirmatively argue that she had a pre-existing neurologic or cardiac condition. But she recognized, even in her informal filings and at length, that she had some preventricular contractions and other types of symptoms.
But she explains them all away in excruciating detail in the filings in this record, right? I mean, like carpal tunnel syndrome, and some of the doctor's records were wrong because she was just reacting to a pill she had taken. So she explains pretty much every one of those, and that was her strong feeling, and she's complaining here under 60b-6 that she should be able to present that case. So you're talking about a scenario where she presents that case, and then you shift gears and you say, never mind that. If she's wrong, if she's not telling the truth, or whatever, we've got another theory to present to you. Is that what you're envisioning, is the extraordinary circumstance here would have required the lawyer to consult her about the choice he made?
Not exactly. So I think the exceptional circumstance here is the fact that the special master issued an order saying, here's the significant aggravation claim. It looks like you might have one at Supplemental Appendix 41 to 48. Then counsel failed to even approach his client. It's undisputed that he never raised the possibility of a significant aggravation claim with her.
But then the same special master had that before him, and he said, no, there was no 60B6 problem. There was no extraordinary circumstance, and he accepted the lawyer's argument this was a matter of strategy not to press this. So you're right, he called it forward, but isn't that argument undone by the fact that that same special master found that this was not an extraordinary circumstance, a finding which we review for abuse of discretion?
No, because I think there's a legal error that underlies that special master's finding. The special master never recognized the legal principle that when a counsel settles or takes comparable action against their client without authority, that is a basis for relief under Rule 60. And that legal principle is undisputed here. So any fact finding that the special master had that might have otherwise undermined this suffers from a legal error that prevents this court from affirming. And I think that's also important here. Even if the court is uncomfortable with reversing on the facts here, there are numerous legal errors in the record that are uncontested and justify at least a remand.
So under the 60B6, only the 60B6 significant aggravation claim, what would be the remedy you are seeking or the range of remedies you think this court has available to it if that were something with which we agreed? Under 60B6, there's a problem in that her counsel basically settled the aggravation claim against her will and knowledge.
I think this court should reverse, remand, and instruct the special master to reopen the case such that she has the opportunity to bring a significant aggravation claim. And even if there are some disputed fact issues that underlie the legal question, a remand would be necessary in that circumstance, but there are no undisputed facts here. It's clear that counsel lacked authority, either expressed or implied, to concede her significant aggravation claim. And the equities tip clearly in her favor to reopening on that basis.
Does that reopening require a hearing?
No, I think it wouldn't require a hearing to rule on the exceptional circumstance. If it's the case that the court remands and there's some fact issue about attorney authority that needs to be resolved below, that would require a hearing. But the ultimate claim for exceptional circumstances under the Vaccine Act system, if it's reopened, that doesn't necessitate a hearing. The special master has general discretion if he needs a hearing, and maybe it would be appropriate in this circumstance, but not necessary.
Do you have any further?
But if the underlying significant aggravation claim were reopened, there might indeed be a need for a hearing to decide that claim for the first time.
Yes, that's right, Judge Toronto, and I think it would be the special master's decision in the first instance because he has discretion about whether a hearing is necessary, but there very may well be a need for a hearing on remand in that circumstance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Day. We'll restore your rebuttal time. Let's hear from counsel for the government. Ms. Lopez, please proceed.
May it please the court, Carolyn Lopez on behalf of the government. If I might, I thought it might be helpful to sort of, we've been talking about this today, to sort of talk about first principles of what should govern any rule that's adopted here. So as the court has been discussing, one really key limitation on reopening, which undoes the importance of finality of judgment, is whether or not the error asserted is material. And for the reasons that were discussed today, we don't think that the error being asserted was material to either of the special master's decisions in the original entitlement decision, which were that she had pre-existing conditions before the vaccination, and because there can only be one onset, she couldn't show that the vaccine was the cause in fact of that.
Ms. Lopez, this is Judge Toronto. I think I understand your point with respect to the precision of the onset date, that is a 60B1 issue as to materiality. I don't understand it as to significant aggravation. There's a whole separate question here about whether if the condition originated pre-vaccination, it got worse, and I don't see that having been litigated.
Yes, Your Honor. And so there, as Amicus has now phrased it, the question before the court is whether or not the special master made a judicial error, and so there, under this case,
I'm sorry. I don't think that's the question on the 60B6.
So I want to make sure.
And for significant aggravation, I don't think that the argument is that was a 60B1 mistake, a judicial error. I understand the mistake and judicial error argument to be entirely about the Chen Fisher records and what they do, how accurate they were in indicating that the relevant symptoms occurred within hours as opposed to within days. So I guess I want to put that completely to one side and focus entirely on the significant aggravation claim. I don't think that's a judicial error claim. I think it's a claim about how what even the special master said was a separate cause of action that is obviously distinct and obviously pleadable in the alternative. Okay, I may have had it according to Dr. Leiss, but sure it sure did get worse. And that's never been litigated, and that was given away.
Yes, Your Honor. So that we don't think, as we described in our brief, we don't think that's a 60B6 question. In our review of the case law, 60B6 has been sharply limited to the attorney abandonment situation, and this isn't really an attorney abandonment situation. So then we're back. The cases we could find, to the degree that they identified which prong of 60B it was, were 60B1 cases, which are the question about when it sort of crosses the line from attorneys deciding as a matter of tactical advantage which theory to press, which we think this is a which theory to press, and I can get to that in 1 second, versus...
I'm sorry. So you want to make it... I don't understand which provision of 60B do you think would be the right provision under which to analyze, either to accept or reject, but under which to analyze an assertion that a cause of action had been irresponsibly, let's say even grossly irresponsibly, waived, given away without the lawyer getting informed consent from the client. Which 60B provision do you want that litigated under?
Yes, Your Honor. So our reading of the case law across the courts of appeals is that it's always treated, I mean, which actually is sort of a harder standard for us because then extraordinary circumstances do sometimes drop away, though, of course, the attorney neglect still has to be excusable, and it's still a difficult standard, but in our understanding, those cases have been 60B1 cases that have to do with when an attorney has acted outside of the scope of their authority to settle or stipulate an independent claim. We don't think that it's a sort of...
And which word under 60B1, please?
We cite this case in our brief. Most of the courts sort of don't provide a textual hook. They say either 60B generally or they'll say 60B1 generally. The Sheng case, which is out of the Eighth Circuit, describes it as sort of the judge made a mistake in thinking that the case was properly settled when it in fact was not, because the attorney lacked
authority. But that's not this case. The significant aggravation claim is a claim about the agent having acted outside his actual authority from the principal without even getting informed consent about a claim that could. Again, by assumption, we're not talking about the merits of this claim, just the nature of the claim that could well have given away the only real possibility for relief.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. I believe I understand what Your Honor is saying. I will say that on the facts of this case, given that petitioner had vehemently told her client over and over again that she did
not. We'll get to the merits. Please don't switch on the merits. I'm trying to understand how a claim of abandonment of an obviously available claim or of a claim that could be a 60B1 as opposed to a 60B6. I understand it might be easier for the plaintiff to proceed under 60B1 if there's no extraordinary circumstances required for 60B1, which I think there isn't. But I don't understand what language under 60B1 would cover that.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, all I can say with apologies is that I looked quite exhaustively at the case law at this, and all of the cases that I could find either said 60B generally or 60B1, and the case law on 60B6, including this court's recent decision in Mora, is that 60B6, the type of gross negligence that's talked about there, really is this total abandonment of representation, often miscoupled by affirmative misleading of the clients. And so, for example, the Ninth Circuit in Latshaw distinguished that type of attorney abandonment from other types of attorney misconduct.
But why don't we kind of have that here? You have the special master suggesting that she may have a significant aggravation claim. You have counsel not litigating that claim, but moreover, on page 151 of the supplemental appendix, you have an email from counsel to his client saying expressly that the special master ruled against her on the aggravation claim, which had not happened. So why don't you have exactly that kind of really substantial misleading about an entire possible claim that she had?
Yes, Your Honor. If I'm understanding that the timing of that email correctly, that's after the decision came down. I don't think that particular instance of misleading is relevant to the question of whether at the time the attorney was making the tactical determination of whether or not to press the significant aggravation theory, to just touch on the merits of that quickly. When the attorney was making the decision as to whether or not to pursue significant aggravation, the fact that his client was quite clearly one of her clearest goals, as has continued before this court, as we were discussing earlier this afternoon, was to not concede that she had any pre-existing conditions. And in light...
Yeah, I get that tension. For sure, I get that tension. This is the hardest issue for me in this case, is the tension between her over and over again sticking to the "I had no pre-existing conditions" concept. So how does her attorney say, well, even if you think that, let's argue in the alternative, a good attorney probably would have. Here, not only do we have this attorney not doing it, we have the special master inviting this attorney to do it. They still didn't do it. And then we have an email, even if it was after the decision, where the attorney claims the special master ruled against them on the aggravation theory that he actually never presented. So why isn't that off? That feels to me awfully close to this abandonment/misleading concept that is the genesis of the 60B6 decisions you've pointed to, and it doesn't feel like it fits to me within the 60B1 rubric.
If your honors think that this is something in this particular instance in which it's not just sort of that an attorney, you know, accidentally without being asked specifically by the special master to brief a particular issue and then didn't talk to his client about it before deciding not to proceed with that, if your honors think that that is the type of thing that would suffice for a narrow remand to ask the special master to take a look at it in his discretion to determine whether or not that was something that could potentially justify reopening in that type of narrow circumstance, that could be an appropriate remedy. But any such ruling, we have real concerns that it not be written in a broad way that would broadly reopen things, because all the time looking in.
You can argue it. It's your time, but you don't have to. I get that litigation choices are made day by day, and these attorneys have to follow their clients, respectfully follow their clients' desires. And here, she said pre-existing. The two facts that are killing me in this whole case are never going to replicate themselves again. So you don't have to worry, at least from my perspective, if there were a decision against the government about it being broad, because the two facts that are driving me crazy are the fact that the special master expressly told him to make an aggravation claim, and he didn't, and he didn't tell his client that or consult with his client about it, and then that he later told his client that the special master ruled against him. That is a very unique set of facts that I don't see. I don't think that opens the door to the mischief that you're worried about if an opinion was narrowly tailored in that way. Do you agree that an opinion narrowly tailored in that way would not create the mischief that you're concerned about? I know you don't agree with that outcome.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your
But
Honor.
What I'm worried about is the mischief. I don't want to cause the mischief that you're concerned about, because I have the same concerns you do. But if an opinion were written that narrowly, is that something that you believe would not open the door wide to a lot of problems?
Yes, Your Honor. So I want to make sure that I absolutely understand sort of the limitations that Your Honor is proposing on such a remand. So that would be in the context of where the special master specifically asked for a briefing on one of the two alternate theories of causation under the Vaccine Act, and the attorney decides not to do that without consulting the client, and later erroneously tells the client, actually, the special master ruled against you, not, I didn't choose to bring that. Do we think that that could be limited in a way that doesn't do mischief? And the answer to that is yes, Your Honor.
So why aren't we settling this case?
Because, Your Honor, we don't think, so here...
Well, because she's asked for a lot more than just that, right?
She and Amicus have asked for sort of a lot of broader rules here, and to be clear, we don't think on the merits that
what is it the special master would be looking at that he hasn't seen before? I mean, when he reviewed this case before him for reopening, did he not have the exact facts you've just been talking to the chief about before him and reject those? So what are we talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. And my apologies, Your Honor. So the government's position is that the special master did not abuse his discretion in light of everything that was in front of him, including that petitioner continued to argue strenuously that she did not have any pre-existing conditions.
So what would be new and different about what we're talking about doing here? What is going to be presented? I mean, he understood that the attorney did not consult his client on this.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what would be different about what he already looked at? I guess I'm just not understanding.
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize for any confusion that I may have caused by trying to make sure that I was answering all the questions before me. So it is the government's continued frontline position, that the special master did not abuse his discretion here, and the special master reasonably concluded that in the context of the specific record where the client had said, you know, one thing that was incredibly important to her over and over again to her attorney was that the attorney made clear she did not have pre-existing conditions, that in that context, the special master was correct, that it was a tactical decision that the attorney couldn't go forward with, and that that actually isn't the type of problem that Chief Judge Moore has raised a concern about. But if the court were instead to agree that there might be to go along the lines of the reasoning that Chief Judge Moore has suggested, we would urge that it be written incredibly narrowly. But
what
again,
is your understanding of what would be narrow? What would be done that would be narrow?
So first of all, it would be a remand and not a reversal ordering reopening, of course, because this would be for the special master to determine in the first instance, or I guess the second or third instance here.
Yeah. What are you saying the special master would be doing that he hasn't done before?
If Your Honors construed his original decision as incorrect in terms of whether or not the attorney had acted so far outside of the bounds of his authority to try to achieve his client's goals, which from the government's perspective is to get Vaccine Act compensation without conceding that she had pre-existing conditions, if the court were to disagree with that, which again, the government agrees that the special master were correct with that, then it would be for the special master in the first instance to determine in these highly specialized circumstances in which the special master had specifically asked for a briefing on this issue and the attorney had declined under the allegation that the attorney actively misled his client as to the potential availability of that theory. We don't think that would necessarily be the right outcome on the record.
So are you saying that he would change his mind? I mean, we'd be telling him to change his mind, right? Because he already reviewed all of these arguments and the circumstances here. He decided it was not a 12B6, not an extraordinary circumstance. So we'd be telling him you were wrong, right? We wouldn't be asking him to just take another look, would we? I mean, I guess I'm a little confused.
Yes, Your Honor. And so, again, I want to be really crystal clear here that the government's position is that the special master did appropriately evaluate.
Right. So, Ms. Lopez, can I just ask, I thought that, among other things, the special master rejected the idea that gross negligence would be sufficient. So that would be one legal error. Did the special master recognize that it might well be a form of a basis to find extraordinary circumstances that the lawyer, when prompted by him, gave up a claim, this claim in particular, without consulting his client? Did he actually say, okay, I appreciate that he didn't consult his client, but that's okay with me because I think this was still a reasonable tactical decision?
So my reading of the special master's decision on reconsideration is that the special master grouped this type of idea, particularly where the client is saying, I don't have pre-existing conditions, as a type of thing that is generally an attorney's tactical decision. So it's sort of irrelevant whether the court specifically asked the person to brief it or not. It still falls within sort of the types of tactical decisions that attorneys can make as to how to best carry out their client's instructions and overall objections, which we agree that the special master didn't abuse his it's the government's frontline position that the special master did not abuse his discretion in so concluding on the record before him, particularly as the person who had had made the original entitlement decision and had issued.
So this is going, I think, beyond the confines that we've been discussing the last 10 minutes or so. But explain to me how, in the circumstances that we have here, it was within the range of responsible attorney-client not to present a, in the alternative, significant aggravation claim. He has a client who says, my personal experience is that I didn't have these symptoms. He already has, from the government's expert saying, actually, we're the experts, you're not, this is Dr. Leiss, I think you did have pertinent symptoms. So he knows, and you believe, because you submitted this, that there will be expert testimony disagreeing with her own view of the significance of the particular symptoms, which is a expert diagnostic matter, not a matter of kind of percipient witness personal testimony. And now, in the face of that real possibility, real because the government's expert has already said it, that her view of the matter about pre-vaccination onset will be rejected, how is it that a responsible attorney doesn't sit down and say, it is absolutely legitimate and may well be the only way you can actually get relief to put on a claim that this got worse, readily available in the alternative pleading. The judge, I forget the exact timing, but at some point the special master recognizes this and says, please address this. This kind of maybe feels like a significant aggravation claim. What would be the downside?
Well, we think sort of the broader downside is that pretty much any time somebody is unhappy with a sort of whether theories have been pressed or not, they could come back in and ask for reopening. So, and that would really wreak havoc on this system, particularly in this context where my understanding is there's something like 4,000 pending open cases.
Okay, but wait, that's theories pressed. This is a separate claim, one the special master specifically called out and believed she may have a case for, told her attorney to brief it, and she didn't. That's not the litigation choice of separate theories. That feels very different to me.
Yes, Your Honor. So we think that in the context of the Vaccine Act, although they're labeled as claims, the significant aggravation claim and the causation in fact claim, they are actually alternate theories of causation. And that's because, unlike other types of independent claims that are sometimes settled or stipulated in cases in which there's sort of a different type of relief at the end of the road, under the Vaccine Act, there's sort of one pot of potential damages, which you can prove either by saying the vaccine was a but-for cause of the condition, or I had a pre-existing condition and the vaccine aggravated that. And so it's really two alternative theories of causation. It's not truly sort of independent claims in the way that we would think about it ordinarily. So, for example, in the Pueblo case that the amicus cites, the original theory was that the United States was trespassing on the tribal land, and then that was bargained away to, and of course, one of the forms of relief with that would be to order the United States to stop trespassing. And then, so that was sort of bargained away to, we will say that the United States did a taking and therefore all we get is sort of money damages for that taking. And so those are two, that's an example of something where you're really talking about two independent claims. And the government's view, significant aggravation and causation, in fact, actually work as alternate theories of causation and not independent claims in the way that that developed case law has talked about settling or stipulating out cases. And so it really falls.
Okay, can you get back to my question though? I'm sitting here and have been for a while, trying to fathom how this conversation does not take place between a lawyer and the client, and maybe it goes in such a way that the client says, "What I care most of all is trying to have people believe me, even though the experts disagree." That sounds pretty unlikely when the lawyer says, "What you really care about is getting relief for harm," and there's a theory of harm in which you get relief even if the bench disagrees with your view about the initial onset. You want to give that up? Okay, now you understand the choice, and maybe she says yes, but I don't understand how that conversation doesn't take place.
Yes, Your Honor, we're not arguing that, you know, ideally, of course we're not arguing that ideally.
I don't mean ideally. We're not talking about ideally. I'm talking about a standard, a minimal responsible securing of informed consent for a plainly available, indeed invited, theory of causation.
Yes, Your Honor. So,
not ideally.
So yes, Your Honor, we think that from prior conversations that the counsel had with petitioners, so this one example of this is in Supplemental Appendix 140, which is petitioner's affidavit describing sort of the course of events from her recollection. And there, so after the very first HHS report that said that she did have pre-existing conditions, her primary concern, as she explained to her lawyer, and when her lawyer followed up again before the supplemental expert reports, was to show that she didn't have pre-existing conditions. So sort of, and as Amicus has phrased it, she was very concerned with what, from her view, was the true version of medical facts. And so, you know, again, the question is, does this particular case rise, if it's under 60B6, under extraordinary circumstances, if it's 60B1, excusable neglect? And we think here it doesn't quite cross that threshold for the reasons I've been discussing today.
So, I mean, it does sound like you think that the conversations or communications that the attorney had with her made it reasonable for him to think she understood that there might well be a choice between a paper vindication and actually recovering money for what she says she's been suffering real harm for. And that she was perfectly fine with standing on principle, even if it meant getting no relief for long-term harm.
We don't think that the special master abused his discretion in determining that, in the context of this record, that fell within the tactical determinations that attorneys can make.
Judge Toronto, I think you've gotten the answer you're going to get. Do you mind if we move on to Mr. Day's rebuttal time?
Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have three quick points on rebuttal. I think something Judge Prost said is why a reversal is required here for significant aggravation rather than any vacatur and remand. The special master had all the facts before him. Where he messed up is he got the law wrong. He failed to recognize that there is a legal principle where an attorney settles or takes comparable action without authority, justifies relief under Rule 60B6. And fundamentally, Rule 60B6 is the kind of well of equitable discretion that it is broad enough to encompass these circumstances that don't, as Judge Toronto noted, fit well into the text of Rule 60B1.
Can you give us what are your best cases for that proposition?
Thomas, out of the Tenth Circuit, is one case where the lack of authority settling a claim counts.
Pueblo, and it settled the entire, that was a case where the entire claim was settled.
Yes.
Okay.
Pueblo from this court, it's, or this court's predecessor, predecessor, the U.S. Court of Claims, involved also a stipulation, and the court was clear that counsel cannot stipulate to compromise their...
And in both those cases, it ended the case. It was a dispositive action taken by counsel to end, terminate, conclude the entire proceeding. Am I right?
Yes, but I don't think that that is a meaningful distinction here, because...
Okay. I don't want to distract you from your 3 points. So.
No, I welcome the question, Your Honor. And I think here, that's not a meaningful distinction because it did end the case with respect to significant aggravation. And I think as Judge Toronto phrased it, it made it such that possibly the only way she could have gotten relief was foreclosed to her without even asking her permission.
Except we're talking about two things. She's complaining about two things. One, and primarily, that she should have been allowed to take the stand, or that the lawyer had to put forth all of these facts that refuted what happened pre-vaccine. And then on the other side of that, well, forget that, pretend I'm wrong, or conclude I'm wrong, and do the other way. So there's kind of two things that go different ways, right?
Yes, there are two things here, but I don't think they necessarily go different ways. It would only require pleading in the alternative, which is expressly contemplated by the claims court's rules, that you can plead claims in the alternative and recognize that the special master may have disagreed on whether there were pre-existing conditions such that significant aggravation was the best avenue. And I think as a second point, fundamentally, these are alternative claims. The Secretary's counsel argued that because you are getting the same relief out of a significant aggravation claim or an initial onset claim, they must be different theories of causation. But just because they're alternative claims doesn't mean that they're not still distinct claims to which the rule about counsel being unable to compromise those claims applies. And I think the last point is that the Secretary's counsel's bottom line position is that the decision should be affirmed, but the Secretary also does not contest the fact that there were numerous legal errors in the decision below. I think there were at least 5. The Special Master didn't apply the right standard for mistake, the 3-step inquiry. The Special Master required exceptional circumstances for fact findings. Special Master failed to recognize the import of attorney conduct and how that bears in multiple ways on the mistake analysis. The Special Master didn't recognize this significant aggravation legal principle, and the Special Master applied a presumption of accuracy that this court has clearly rejected. So if there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
I thank both counsel for their argument. This case is taken under submission.